the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. This is Brooke Medina, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ray Nothstein. And we have a special guest today. We have Daniel DeSalvo. He is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and is also an associate professor of political science in the Colin Powell School at the City College of New York. So thank you so much for being on with us today, Dan.
My pleasure to be with you.
We're glad to have you here. And in particular, we wanted to have you on because we know that you have just released, and Manhattan Institute has released, a report that specifically focuses on North Carolina. So we're going to get to that, but we want to hear a little bit more about you first and introduce you to our audience. So what's kind of your background and what got you even interested in the field that you're in?
Well, I'm a political scientist with a PhD, and I'm the chair of the political science department at City College, and a lot of my research deals with political parties and interest groups in state and local politics in the United States. And I have a specific interest in, you could say, state and local public finance and labor relations. So I wrote a book about public employee unions a few years ago, and I've subsequently become quite interested in the legacy costs issue, so pensions and retiree health care for public employees.
Yeah, and that that seems to be something that doesn't get nearly enough attention, but is sort of like this ticking time bomb and something that I think will kind of blindside American taxpayers if we're not careful.
I think that's one of the features of that makes the politics of these issues, you know, so fascinating and interesting, is it's mostly an iceberg that's underwater that people can't really see. And that obviously gives lots of room for people to take action in this area, both in good and bad ways. And at least historically, it's probably given an opportunity to run up the costs of these programs without the public having much information about what was going on.
Mm-hmm. And, I'll let Ray ask some follow-up with the next question, but just to kick us off, why should the average North Carolinian, maybe someone that's in the private sector or someone that's retired already, why should they care about this issue?
Well, certainly for someone in the private sector, it's very simple. The state's overall fiscal health and fiscal climate is going to, you know, affect the attractiveness of North Carolina for investment and for economic growth. If one is going to make very extensive promises to public employees in terms of retirement compensation, but then not set aside any money to pay for those promises, eventually as the bill starts to come due, that's going to require new taxes or new revenues from somewhere to pay for those costs, and that obviously can impact all kinds of private sector decisions. So that would be the big point of view from the private sector and the state's overall health.
Daniel, what's unique about North Carolina? Obviously, most of our listeners are in North Carolina, but you know, when it comes to pension reform, we hear about all these states that are upside down in their pension, retirement, health benefits. What's unique to North Carolina that's different than other states?
Well, my study of North Carolina and what it did in 2017 that really caught my attention was something dealing with the retiree health care portion of retirement benefits for public employees. And that, every state passed a pension reform in the wake of the Great Recession. But the pension politics are a little separate from retiree health care. And so many public employees can enjoy, if they retire before they're Medicare eligible, and then even once they're on Medicare for the rest of their lives, receive benefits in the form of insurance and other subsidies from their previous government employers. And North Carolina has, you know, I think provided a way of slowly moving away from offering those benefits, because they probably, in my view, served little public purpose. So beginning next year, January, anyone hired by the state will no longer be eligible for those retirement benefits or health care in retirement.
That seems like I guess for people that are used to this, maybe older employees, older workers, they're used to this sort of pension setup where health care is guaranteed. And so this seems like a hard pill to swallow for some people. But I know that the labor landscape is changing. The average tenure of an employee that's a younger adult is about 4.5 years versus 10 plus years for older Americans. So do you foresee the retirement benefit sort of compensation packages evolving to meet the preferences of digital natives and people that are in this sort of new fourth industrial revolution that are just entering the labor market compared to those in the past that expected these sort of benefits?
Well, there's a lot to your question, so I'll try to be
sorry
in addressing it. But I'd say in the Manhattan Institute report, I go into both dimensions of this, which is first that North Carolina took a step back all the way back in 2005 to increase the years of continuous employment required to qualify for full medical retirement benefits, and from 5 to 20 years. So anyone working for the state, you know, post 2005 that started their employment then would have to work for a full 20 years before they could receive this benefit, which means a relatively small percentage of current North Carolina employees are going to qualify for this benefit anyway. And that's the case elsewhere. Most people would leave public employment before they ever got this. So in some sense, it was an illusory or false promise to young employees. Mm-hmm. As to your point as whether this is sort of draconian and cutting people off, I'd say two things. First is every new employee will know the deal. And for those employees, they'll be at the beginning of their careers and they have a long time to plan and adjust for retirement, you could say at that point. Mm-hmm. And second, there are other options that could be done collectively, or you could say privately, by employees, whether through their union representatives or associations that they might form. And I give some examples of what are called retiree medical trusts, which is basically like a defined contribution plan for retiree healthcare costs. And so there's lots of time in the future now that public employees have a credible commitment that the state as an employer is not going to offer this anymore, that they could certainly do something on their own. And last, the healthcare landscape has changed, which is that, you know, for many people, there's the private insurance market is now subsidized through the Affordable Care Act exchanges. And many people, even those who retire before they become Medicare eligible from public employment, often take other jobs that have health insurance, or they can receive health insurance from their spouse. So the notion that people are going to get to the end of their careers and not really have access to health care when they're older and more likely to suffer health problems, I think that's certainly been reduced in the current environment, making this North Carolina policy both fiscally prudent and not so draconian.
Daniel, I've got a question. It's a little bit off topic, but it's a lot of interest to me. I mean, it's a pretty big interest to me, and I don't know if we could ever get to a point like this, but just watching the news, you see a lot of eruptions in Paris over pension reform and in European countries. Certainly, it's a different culture in terms of government involvement, and, you know, government as a caretaker is stronger in those countries. But do you see that kind of – I don't think we'll see that kind of maybe mob violence, so to speak, but what's going to be, you know, the pushback going forward if states are going to get aggressive in terms of, especially in some of these states that may be culturally different than North Carolina, at least from a political standpoint, with some of maybe the pushback on some of these pension reforms? I mean, is it just going to be primarily judicial, or are you going to see more people taking to the streets, or more people pushing back with public protests?
Well, I think, you know, in this case, we've certainly seen some labor unrest in the public sector over the last 2 years. We're actually probably at a high point of it, given the recent wave of teacher strikes, you know, both in so-called red states, but also in big blue cities like Los Angeles and Chicago. And if you look at those places, what's one of the driving factors leading to these contentious political moments? It's, take Los Angeles, for example. One of the reasons that the LA Unified School District couldn't offer, you know, better raises for its teachers was in part because it has very high costs and very large promises of retiree health care benefits for teachers, which as those costs increase, there's just less money left over for salary. So as a sort of backstory here, the political crunch is that, you know, people want to have more, as public employees would like more pay in the here and now, as almost all of us would, but their government employers have made these really extensive promises in the past that are now, the bill for those are starting to come due or is increasing, and that's putting them in a kind of a fiscal vice.
You know, I think that just what you pointed out right there is so instructive for today's American voters. Just in case anyone wasn't aware, we're in an election year, right? And so we have politicians on both sides making a lot of lofty promises, and yet just like these local and state public employers made these huge promises, and the delivery of them is really what proves to be challenging, because at the end of the day, math is still math, and we have to be able to afford these things, especially if we're a state government. We don't get to print our own money like the federal government. And so there is a lot more that restrains us, and rightfully so, from making promises that we're really not able to keep. But the pain is that those that came before us made these sort of promises, and now today's taxpayers are left holding the bag.
That's why I think this is why I bothered to write the report on North Carolina. And I guess I would say something I think goes to both points you made, Brooke, and you too, Ray, which is thinking about the politics of this. I mean, North Carolina's reforms of its retiree health care, or sometimes called other post-employment benefits, or OPEB in the technical language, instructive is not that it's going to be a model for my home state of New York and New York City. It's not. The politics here are very different. You know, we have very large and powerful public employee unions that create a really different landscape. But there's a whole bunch of other states that have similar, you could say, political landscapes to North Carolina. That is, they have high OPEB liabilities in the billions of dollars, but they have relatively weak public sector unions, and they might be able to, in a sense, use North Carolina as a model. And that would include states like Alabama, South Carolina, Texas. So really the report is meant to offer North Carolina as a model to those places, rather than to the New Yorks or Californias of the world, where the landscape is much, much different.
And what is our OPEB liability here in North Carolina? How many billion?
About rounding up slightly, about $34 billion.
$34 billion. And I see that. So we're out of the states that you mentioned in your report. You listed Georgia, South Carolina, Texas, Alabama. We have the greatest liability other than Texas out of that list, which Texas is $88.2 billion, which is incredibly high, but they're a huge state. Everything's bigger in Texas, right?
They have a much, much larger population. And just remember, New York City, where I'm sitting, has an OPEB liability of $88 billion, and that's just New York City, not the whole state.
Wow.
So things can get much bigger, but North Carolina was ranked very high in its OPEB liabilities, especially if you look at the numbers on a per capita basis. And this was also entangled with obviously some contentious politics in North Carolina over the state health care plan, which is the health care plan for public employees. And this reform over time, as it begins to take effect, and the number of employees in North Carolina that the state has made a promise to starts to decline, that will also have the added benefit of probably improving the fiscal outlook of the state and health insurance plan, which has had some problems and been the subject of a lot of recent legislation.
I've got a question just related to the politics of this. I know you're familiar with Del Falwell, but he seems to be the only, and it's the nature of his position as state treasurer, but he seems to be the only person in North Carolina really talking about this. And I don't know the dynamics so much of other states and who's pushing, whether it be pension reform or just reform to some of these retiree health benefits. But, you know, kind of walk us through maybe some politicos or people who have the courage to kind of address this issue, because I see this in North Carolina where I don't hear other even Republicans talking about this issue so much unless it's Del Falwell. And some of them may be in agreement, but they don't seem to be carrying any water for him or others on this as well. So I don't know if you can walk us through that just a little bit in terms of the political dynamics.
Yeah, I think 2 points. I'd say Falwell, I think you're absolutely right, has been, you know, a real leader on this issue and really pointed it out. And obviously he came before he was treasurer from the legislature. So he had experience there. And that, I think, has been valuable. You know, he also, due to, again, some prior legislation, the state treasurer's office now manages the state health plan for public employees. So in that sense, this is really part of his main remit. So there's a reason for him being a leader. And I would say that insofar as, you know, a number of the state legislators that got together and made this reform, meaning moving away beginning next January from offering these benefits and got it passed through the state budget bill, that showed there was appetite for this in the legislature. And so there are a number of mostly Republicans, and this is partly they've been aided by the fact that the Republicans have had large either majorities or supermajorities in both chambers to push through some of these policies.
Daniel, I got a question too. Just, you know, if we're distilling this into like a few minutes, the average voter out there, the average citizen, they look at these numbers and, you know, maybe it's way off into the future, but how do you distill this stuff when you're out there talking about this issue to the taxpayer, meaning what it's going to cost you going forward? How do you kind of sound the alarm on this? I think Falwell has done it pretty well in North Carolina. But again, I mean, you don't see any courage. You know, if you look at the federal government, there's no ability to tackle entitlement reform to any degree. So, you know, how do you kind of help convince maybe the taxpayer out there that this is a monumental issue that needs to be addressed?
Well, I mean, I think there's certain ways to get people to pay attention to it. And certainly I think in the North Carolina case, Falwell was able to really bring some numbers to bear on this. And I think we've not just in North Carolina, but on this, say, the broader issue of retirement benefit promises to public employees. Gina Raimondo, you know, from the other party, a Democrat, you know, had a truth in numbers campaign that was very successful in helping at least shore up or fix Rhode Island's public pension system. And that was just doing the kinds of things like Falwell has done, is to try to take the big numbers like the $34 billion we were talking about and break it down, say, on a per capita basis, meaning every man, woman, and child in North Carolina is, in a sense, on the hook for about $3,000 worth of payments for its retiree health care liability. Or looking at the state budget and saying, in North Carolina's case, they were inching up, if you put together the retirement promises for health care and the retirement promise for pensions, that was getting close to about 20% of the state budget. And you say, well, if we have to pay 20%, that means there's only 80% left for everything else that the state might want to do. So that, I think, gives people things they can get their mind around. And then you've got the bad examples out there of what happens if you really don't get a handle on these issues. And that those are really, say, Illinois and Puerto Rico. And of course, some of the California cities that declared bankruptcy, retiree healthcare was a big portion of that. So those negative examples can be instructive as well.
Just a short follow-up. I saw you mention in your piece that there were judicial decisions that, you know, throw out any sort of pension reform, and it puts more obligation on the government. I mean, do you have a thought on that? Do you have something when you point to sort of on the legal proceedings, what that kind of says to you? Does that really inhibit the government to do any reform? Is that a bad thing? Is there some positives to these legal decisions? Do we see a consistent, decision when there is a judicial decision made on some of this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think here it's really important to make, when it comes to some of the legal issues, it's really important to separate pensions and retiree health care when we're talking about retirement benefits for public employees. For pensions, basically they're considered contracts, and the monies have been set aside in inviolable legal trusts, which makes reforming pensions a really uphill battle. And it's very difficult to change, certainly outside of bankruptcy, impossible legally to change the benefits for people who are already retired or people who are working in state and local government but who have not, who have already vested in these systems. So really, almost all the reform of public pensions that we saw in the wake of the Great Recession really just touched on what would be called new hires, or people who had yet to be hired by the state. The policies would only apply to them, and states would only, and localities would only see the benefits of those reforms long into the future. The difference with retiree health care is it doesn't have such ironclad contractual protections, and meaning the state and local governments have a much freer hand to alter the benefit promises offered to people, and I think that's legitimate. I mean, you do want to be cautious about cutting benefits for people who are already on fixed income and in retirement or are close to that, just because that's a hard thing to do and it's morally problematic. Mm-hmm. People have sort of made their retirement plans and they're 62, and then all of a sudden someone's going to change the bargain. That can be very complicated and difficult. But that's why I think North Carolina's plan here gives a lot of lead time and lets people have time to plan and make alternative arrangements if they think they're going to need certain healthcare benefits in retirement.
Yeah, that you make a good case for the state of North Carolina's approach, and certainly how we can set an example for some of the other states that are in similar boats as us. And I know it's something Ray and I have discussed on the podcast multiple times, is just the ethics behind fiscal responsibility, but also, like you noted, making sure that we're also keeping our word to those that we did make some of these larger promises to, who are now reaching retirement age and they're banking on those promises being kept. And so it can be a messy issue when you're trying to walk back some of these promises, but definitely am encouraged by what our state is doing and really appreciate you delving into this and highlighting it. I do want to ask you one more question. I know we're running out of time here, but I know that in your bio, you also focus on elections. And like we mentioned, we've got one coming up, but I was curious about your thoughts, because our neighbors to the north in Virginia just passed a bill to give the electoral votes to a popular vote winner. And you see this with each election, especially as of late, it seems like there's just greater calls for abolishing the Electoral College. And so I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, because some of the progressive lawmakers in our state have also expressed support for such a position and bill.
Well, it's complicated. I mean, in effect, you would say if a critical mass of states were to ever pass laws that in effect undermine the Electoral College, that might force Washington to act where it's been quite reluctant to act. And it's not clear that you could have a change to the Electoral College without a constitutional amendment, which is, of course, a very high lift. So a lot of chaos in between those two things could ensue. I think the thing people should just keep in mind is, you know, even if they don't like the Electoral College, what is the alternative system that they have in mind? Most people seem to think they want just a one-shot plurality election, even though almost no nation in the world does that. So do they want a runoff system like France or Brazil? People really haven't given much thought. Some people don't like the Electoral College, but they haven't given a lot of thought to what the alternative would look like. So I'd say that people should be pressed on thinking about through that before they want to take steps to get rid of the Electoral College.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's totally crazy. I mean, you're basically handing your votes to California and other big, large populous states. I mean, I think it just shows a lack of a sort of civic education, and you were more polite in the way that you said that in terms of people not understanding
what the framers
are. But I mean, I think it's just a lack of civic education and protecting what the founders set up was that states play a role in our republic. They play a large role, and we've eroded that to some degree already, and to erode it even more just doesn't make any sense to me when we're trying to preserve different distinctions in our land and different distinctions in our nation about how we select a federal leader. So you were very polite, I thought.
I appreciate that.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today. And where can our audience find this report at?
The Manhattan Institute's website. It's, if you just look up, Manhattan Institute and my name and health and retiree healthcare, I'm sure you'll find it very easily on Google, or that's probably the best place to look.
Well, we very much appreciate the work you and Manhattan Institute are doing. And thank you for your time and coming on the show today.
Yeah, thank you, Daniel. We really appreciate it. We're big fans of the Manhattan Institute, so thank you so much.
My pleasure to be with you.